and welcome to the first of LSTM's podcast series, where we meet some of the most curious minds in science. I'm Lee Bowman, and today we'll be catching up with Professor Paul Garner, who will be speaking with Kayla Barnes about the importance of systematic research in evidence-based medicine, and then with Professor Steve Torr and Chris Spencer, where they discuss Steve's recent research on African trypanosomiasis and what his team are doing to combat the vector tsetse fly.
Today I'm speaking with Professor Paul Garner, the coordinating editor of the Cochrane Infectious Disease Group here at LSTM. Paul has over 20 years of experience assessing the effects of healthcare and health implementation. Professor Garner, welcome to the podcast. Could you explain what a Cochrane review is, just for the general public and also for the scientific community?
Yeah, thanks, Carla. A Cochrane review is a specific sort of systematic review. It is a systematic review that is published electronically and is an output of a large collaboration of over 20,000 people worldwide that got together about 20 years ago to try and sort out health and medical care in relation to systematic reviews. Because up to that point, people had spent an enormous amount of time doing primary research about the effects of healthcare, but hadn't invested the same scientific methods in producing the summaries of that. So this group said this is a scandal, and that it needs fixing. And so it was an organisation that came together around all aspects of healthcare. We've just got one little bit of the picture that we help coordinate from here. These systematic reviews are different from other publications because they're published entirely electronically and they use standard methods that the whole collaboration has produced, and they are updated over time. In other words, as new trials appear, these are incorporated into new editions of the review that are then published. The other critical point about Cochrane reviews is they are very clear about interpreting the evidence in the light of the quality of that evidence, which not all reviews do.
Interesting, thank you. And I think you said it involves a lot of people, thousands of people. Could you just touch on some of the players that help inform these Cochrane reviews?
So the main group of people producing a review are the review team. So the review team are critical to the process. The review team consists of several authors. They need people with topic experience, understand the topic. It needs people with statistical knowledge and methodological knowledge. So this group of people need to get together. The authors of these reviews need to be fastidious, careful people that are not highly opinionated. So highly opinionated people are complicated in systematic reviews because they tend to pull the interpretation of the results in the way that they think is right. So we're looking for people that have an open mind, often young people, because they have a lot more open minds than old people.
I'm not going to comment on that.
No. So that is the review team that commit to producing the review. A review may take, on average, 18 months to 2 or 3 years. These are pieces of research. Constantly people think that these reviews are like you used to do in the past. You can do them in an afternoon on the bus home. But they're not. They're pieces of research, and they take as long as primary research does. There's also teams of people that referee, edit, and provide technical input. So the thing about the Cochrane Collaboration is that it's a very supportive organisation and tries to help people get things done rather than put things in the way. It's an organisation that encourages collaboration and not competition.
Thank you. So some of the reviews you've been involved in have had direct consequences for actually how we use health and how we implement healthcare in both the UK but also in endemic countries. Can you just give us a couple examples of some of these reviews that have led to outcomes that are a bit more tangible?
One of the early reviews Christian Lengler from the Swiss Tropical Institute did brought together mortality studies in impregnated mosquito nets. And those individual studies were encouraging in their effect on mortality, but when they were combined in a statistical meta-analysis, showed a very clear impact on child mortality and provided a very substantive evidence base, a solid evidence base, for investing in that intervention.
And is then, did the WHO use that when they were educating the communities they were working in, or how did that get passed on to the country?
Well, it basically, that kind of information helps justify to donors investment in the programs. Mm-hmm. But you're right, in the sense, if a systematic review comes out with a 20 or 30% reduction in mortality, this is a very tangible bit of information that can be expressed to users of this intervention to say that it works. So I agree with you. One of the things that systematic reviews do is demystify the science behind these things, because it boils it down to simple outcomes that people can understand.
And one of the other reviews you worked on deals with deworming, and I've heard that it's a little bit of a controversial issue right now. Can you just touch on that?
Yeah, the certainly reviews that are in line with current thinking are very popular reviews because they support what the scientists are thinking. The deworming review is a review that I personally have been working on for over 15 years, and it raises questions about the investment in a policy of deworming every school child in Africa, and asks whether the evidence is sufficient to justify this huge investment. And that has not been popular in some areas, because there's a lot of people that consider that it is a cost-effective intervention, and a lot of people are working hard on this. So because there are so many current investments in this area, it is quite challenging to people. So it's created debate. It's much better to create debate than have no debate at all and be ignored. So I think the debate is a constructive one.
And another one of your studies that actually did lead to maybe a more positive, not to say that deworming wasn't positive, but a more tangible outcome for childcare was the oral rehydration salts.
Yes.
Study that you had done.
Yeah, that was some years ago, and it was at a time when researchers were asking the question of whether the sachets used to rehydrate children, the little ORS sachets, had too much salt in them. A number of trials had been done, and these trials had compared what was then the normal strength solution with a weaker solution. But it's a small difference, and the differences in the trials was quite, it was ambiguous about, it wasn't very clear, there wasn't a clear message. But the meta-analysis done by Seokin Han, with support from us, showed quite clearly that the solution with less salt in led to less vomiting in the children and fewer children requiring intravenous drips putting up. Mm-hmm. So it was obvious that this lower salt solution was better. And within 18 months, that led to a change, a global change in the ORS formula. It was our new results coming out of a meta-analysis across the existing trials. So it's an example of a systematic review helping produce new knowledge by aggregating and bringing together statistically the result from several trials.
That's a really interesting study, and the impacts are seen for the last, now, what, 20 years? So
yeah.
Very exciting. Well, I think that wraps up our time with you. Thank you, Professor. If you would like to get more information about Cochrane Reviews or some of the work that Professor Gardner is working on, you can visit his staff profile at the LSTM website. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kyla.
Thank you, Kayla. Very interesting information about the importance of evidence-based medicine. Now we head over to Chris Spencer and Professor Steve Tall.
Hi there, I'm Chris Spencer. Today I'm going to be speaking with Steve Tall about his recent work, which looked at which factors might affect the propensity of tsetse flies to enter houses and attack humans. Welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
So, Steve, you're studying the tsetse fly, the vector for African trypanosomiasis.
Yeah, that's right. We're working on there's two forms of sleeping sickness. There's the so-called Rhodesian sleeping sickness, which is associated with the savannas of East and Southern Africa, and in particular associated with wilderness areas. And another form we're working on is the Gambian sleeping sickness, and that's probably the more important version. It's found in West and Central Africa and is associated with riverine areas. But the work we're talking about today is the Rhodesian form and work we were doing in national parks in Southern Africa, in Zimbabwe in particular. And that in Manipals, there's been a long history of not many cases, but most years there'll be one or two cases of sleeping sickness every year, and which is typical really of all the large game parks of Eastern Southern Africa, where there's an abundance of tsetse flies and wild hosts, which are natural reservoirs for the parasites that cause sleeping sickness. And so what we've been doing is thinking about, for people living and working in those parks, where really an intervention, sort of classical intervention of elimination of flies is not going to be possible, what people might do and what the authorities, say for instance national park authorities, what they might do to protect their staff, and governments might do to protect people living around the edges of those parks.
So what are the general methods you use to look at this question? Did you work with local people, or how did you do it?
Well, in this, the particular research station is at Rakomachi, is in the middle of the Zambezi Valley, and we're actually working with staff from the tsetse control branch, the Zimbabwe tsetse control branch, and they spend their lives working in this particular area, so we're working with staff and people living there. And then we're looking at, really mapping across the day what happens to them. So we have various methods of just catching flies, yeah, using electric nets and trapping methods. Also just collecting flies as they settle in houses and catching them as they land on people.
Okay, great. And you mentioned about the data you got suggesting that some of the older flies were entering the houses. So was that the only key result, or what were the key results of this study?
Yeah, so first of all, why were these flies naturally feed on wild animals like warthog, buffalo, so why were they coming into houses? So that's one of the things we started to look at. And what seems to be the case, in the hottest parts of the year, flies go into what we call refuges, natural refuges like rot holes, to escape temperatures that would be lethal to them otherwise. So what happens during the dry season, the hot dry season, sort of September, October, these flies are moving into houses and just using them as refuges. And then what we also think seems to be happening is that the flies themselves then get trapped in the house. They also become more desperate and to feed and sort of less fussy. These particular species of tsetse don't tend to feed on humans. In fact, they're repelled by them. But once they're in the house, they're faced, if you like, with a choice between either dying or feeding, and so make the rational decision to anthropomorphize the whole situation to feed on a human. Also, probably they're being habituated. You know, they're exposed to, we have natural repellents that we produce, and that sort of constant exposure across the day means those repellents probably aren't effective.
Okay, that's quite interesting stuff. So you mentioned that they're coming in indoors to sort of shelter from the heat, as it were. Can you see that there might be any sort of links between that behaviour and climate change in the future? I mean, things are getting warmer potentially.
Yeah. So what it sort of relates to the probability of entering a house, and also, you know, if you like, that that balance between host choice and starvation. And what happens is the hotter parts of the year or in hotter climates, the balance, if you like, moves more and more towards entering in houses and biting humans. So what we think might happen is that in warmer situations, say seasons, or if there are climate change effects that impact on Zimbabwe, that there will be a shift, or there could be a shift towards biting humans. And we sort of see that Southern Africa had two or three severe droughts over the last 20 or 30 years. And during those periods, there has been, we can see shifts in sort of mortality rates and in the balance of the probability of tsetse biting humans.
Okay, and would you use any of that data to sort of inform travel information or any sort of tsetse forecasts, as it
were? Yeah, well, sort of. So in some ways, we were interested. People involved, you know, the tourist industry, for instance, for Tanzania is worth something like over $10 billion a year. You know, it's a very big income earner for the country, and also for people living in those areas, either working in it or for the local communities, livestock keepers and so forth all around the edges of the park. So there's a lot of interest and need for how do we deal with these parks themselves are potential focus of disease for humans and livestock. So we're interested in what might be the risk in the future, how might we mitigate that risk, and how might we manage the situation without, for instance, eliminating the park and the animals in it. So some of them are about sort of, we're interested in person protection, for instance, are there repellents that might work? And repellents and those sort of strategies just don't seem to work in these domestic situations, probably for the same reason that our natural repellents don't work.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do think you could do, for instance, is use the sort of methods that we've used to control malaria mosquitoes by just indoor spraying of houses. That in itself might actually be effective against tsetse.
Okay.
And then in as you say, sort of predicting how you might manage the risk. So across the dry season, for instance, taking the hot dry season, taking measures that would make sure that flies either can't get in, or if they do get in, they're killed. So that might be just really quite simple measures, which aren't happening at the moment, but could have a significant effect on risk.
Great. So have you got any future plans to do any further research in the area, geographical area or research area?
So we've just done this work really in one particular settlement in northern Zimbabwe. And so we've just recently got WHO TDR funding to expand that work. So what we will now start to look at is what's happening more broadly across northern Tanzania and northern Zimbabwe. So not only in the parks themselves and in the offices of people working there, but also for the communities around the edge. So is the same phenomenon that we see in a sort of research, slightly artificial setting, is that also happening and being replicated in communities all around the edges of parks?
Fantastic. That sounds like promising ground for research. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. That was an excellent insight into the forefront of tsetse research. Now, before we go, I'd like to highlight that March is the month of International Women's Day and World TB Day. They take place on Saturday the 8th of March and Monday the 24th of March, respectively. So I hope you've enjoyed listening and that you'll join again for the next podcast from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine.